As I said, there's going to be, I think, three sermons coming out. And this, in this first chapter we've read today, the thing I really want to get across to you is the importance of living worthy of the gospel. Living worthy of the gospel. How can I live my life in such a way as it actually reflects the importance of what Christ has done? And I think the answer to that, it hinges around the importance of fellowship, a commitment to fellowship. So that's the thing I want to really focus on today. And then in the second chapter, where if you've got it down there, it says the man of lawlessness, you'll see that there's already in the first chapter a mention of heaven, there's a mention of hell, but there are sort of troubles coming on the earth. The man of lawlessness, the end times, those sort of things. So we're gonna probably another time deal with that second section there. But although there are great things to come and there are terrible things to be experienced on the earth as well, there's a sense in the end, in the third chapter, which I think is in the Second World War, the ministry of something produced this poster, which was going to be circulated around the country in the event that we were invaded. And the poster, it's become very famous now, said, "Keep calm and carry on." And it's gone viral, hasn't it? You know, we never got invaded, never got to use it, but 100 years later or whatever, 60 years later, it's rather popular. But I think in the end, that's what his conclusion is, that there will be a final judgment. There will be terrible things on earth. But you and me, what have we got to do? Carry on. Make sure you carry on. So that's going to be the next couple of sessions. But we're dealing with this first chapter, aren't we? The introduction, you've got the regrouping of Paul and Silas together and Timothy. They've got back together after there's been some comings and goings, and he's writing again to the same church that we saw in the first letter to the Thessalonians, obviously responding to news. And what you can see is that he's starting to build a relationship, an ongoing relationship. It's not just a one-hit wonder. It's something that's building and developing. That's very, very important, because his ministry is not just something like as he turns up in town, does great signs, and people get to faith, and then he's off. He remains committed to them, and they remain evidently committed to him. There's an accountability, there's a relationship, And it's out of the fruit of our Christian relationships that whatever ministry we have, whatever fruit there's going to be, will grow out of the reality of a real living relationship with Christ worked out in our personal lives and our relationships to each other. And these people are under pressure. They're a community under pressure. And the community that we are and other Christians around the world all face very different kinds of pressure. But if you think you're not facing any pressure as a Christian just because people aren't smashing our windows at the moment, and thank God for that, we've been mistaken. There's a cultural pressure. There's a spiritual pressure at work on Christians all around the world. It's just a part of our spiritual warfare. It's just a fact. And we have to contend with that. And these people were dealing with that pressure in such a way it was exemplary. The way they dealt with those pressures was such that Paul could point to them and say, "You want to know how to deal with the pressures of Christian life in this day and age? Look at these guys." And that's to do with the reality of their relationship and the accountability and the fellowship that they had, their commitment to one another, as we're going to see. Now, if you're like me, when you have problems, I know that I'm not the only one who has problems, okay? But when you have problems, I find that I get sucked into the problems. They become very consuming, very absorbing. And if I'm not careful, I will lose sight of the big picture. And I think what he's saying to these people, because they're under pressure, they're facing difficulties, and they're so consumed by the problems that they're facing, that their faith, their sense of the big picture of what God is doing, the ultimate great plan of redemption, is coming out of focus. So it's really helpful, isn't it, to have people. You know, I love it when, you know, you're dealing with a problem. I remember one brother, he just said to me, I was really in the trenches with something. And he said, you know, I love it where it says in the Bible, "And it came to pass." And it came to pass. And it just helped me stop for a minute and just realize, you know, everything is passing. Come on, breathe a bit, you know, breathe. We were talking earlier about 1 Thessalonians, which says, in every circumstance, rejoice, give thanks. Well, sometimes you just feel, oh, what have I got to give? Just stop and thank God. It really just, you see the big picture. And that's what he's doing, isn't he? He's saying, I know you're in difficulties. I know you have problems. Step back, see the big picture. See what God is, see where we're going, people. see where you're going. So that's important, isn't it, to do that. Again, you know, when I drive a car and I get lost, it's awful, isn't it? You look, you're sort of like focusing on it. And actually, sometimes you've got to stop. I know it's embarrassing. And ask somebody for directions. Somebody who's got the big picture, who knows the area. And it helps you, doesn't it? And then we can get on with, when we get back into that place, we can get on with the business of living worthy of the gospel and not getting consumed by our problems or even by our joys. And that's what we were sort of, you know, Richard was pointing out this morning. Sometimes it's not bad things, it can be good things. And I think everybody knows, the Christians around the world, when they look at us, look into the Western Christianity, they say, those poor Christians, they're really suffering over there. They're so consumed by material opportunities. They've got so much paperwork to fill out. Their jobs are so consuming and absorbing, their careers. There's so much on TV. We don't have any of that. So we all face different kinds of troubles that can distract us from our real and immediate need. And you were bringing it out this morning, Andy. Our real immediate need is to know Christ. To know Christ and have proper, real, living, vibrant fellowship, out of which will come everything that we need to glorify God. So these are the subjects that we're dealing with. To realize that we have to live our lives in the light of tomorrow, today, and live brightly for Jesus. Okay, that's my introduction. Right, let's get down into the text. The first section. These opening lines, Paul, Silas, Timothy, and so on and so forth, we can see very straightforwardly who's the writer. The writer is Paul. He's with the same people that we read about in 1 Thessalonians as well. The people who are receiving the letter, it's the same people. Nothing very exciting to say there, is there? You know, it's the same people talking to the same people. It's just the same stuff going on. They're writing letters. There's some sort of a correspondence. We don't know how many letters were being exchanged or messages going backwards and forwards, but we do know at least we have two here, and probably that's part of a wider communication. And I'll tell you why that's important, why I think it's important, because it shows that they have an ongoing commitment to each other. It's not very glamorous, it's not very exciting sometimes to do the same thing again and again and again and again and see the same people again and again and communicate oftentimes the same thing, grace and peace to you, to greet, to say hello, to say please, to say thank you, to show the common courtesies, the care, to acknowledge each other. There's nothing very glamorous about it. But I tell you, once those things go out of your life, you miss them so badly. It's the bread and butter of life, isn't it? Just that ordinary, the ordinary part, the positive side of just seeing each other, speaking to each other, communicating, loving each other, building each other up, showing interest. People can be dismissive of how are you? You know, do make a little bit of time to hear the answer. And do make a little bit of time to ask the question and mean it. And to take an interest in each other. That's what they're doing. They're concerned for each other. There's an interest in each other. And this Paul and Silas and Timothy and these men, they've been kind of coming and going. They've been going here, but they're coming back together again. They mean something to each other. They have something in common. They've got some common ground. You know, if I don't know what your professions are, your backgrounds, your experiences, but perhaps, I don't know, if you've been in the army or something like that, you kind of get together with a group of people who've been in the army, and you've got a lot of hooks to hang things on, haven't you? You know, where were you? I was in Germany, and you talk about that, and which camp, blah, blah, blah. And you've got a lot of in common things, haven't you? Fellowship, true fellowship, is when what you have in common is Christ. And you really do. Jesus said, if where your treasure is, that's where your heart is going to be. And you'll seek out those who have this treasure in common. How are you in Christ? How's your life in Christ? And that needs to be a real thing, doesn't it? I mean, you know, it's the wannabes who come along, you know, say, you can tell presumably the difference between somebody who's actually been in the army and somebody who hasn't. From their experience. And a Christian has a unique experience. And that's an experience you can share. And it's an experience you can learn from others as well. Somebody else can show you things. They've gone before you. They know something you don't know. And it's important, isn't it? There's this fellowship, this communication, this regular flow of communication that's going on between about their shared things that they have in common concerning Christ. concerning his glory, concerning the work that he's given us to do, how we can achieve it, how can we help, where are we struggling, what can we do better? And they're interested in each other. I mean, the truth is, between these two letters, there's lots of things here that are the same. There's lots of encouragements, there's lots of ordinary things, and truthfully, the Christian life is not all entirely glamorous. There's a lot of repetition. There is a lot of same old, same old. It's like eating your dinner. I know it's kind of predictable, but I have breakfast every day, mostly. And I usually have a bit of lunch. And I know on Facebook people take photographs of their lunch and paste it up there. I'm not sure it's news. I'm not sure it's particularly newsworthy. But there it is. There's a lot of them in the Christian life that is not particularly newsworthy. But it's good. And it's important. And without it, you feel the difference very, very fast. You begin to drift. You begin to go cold. You lose your bearings. You lose your way very, very easily. But when it's there and it's been built on, you get then the opportunity. See, when you're there, now I want to clarify here, this is not about attending meetings. Okay, let's just clarify this. Although it's not about attending meetings. When you're there doing the ordinary things, the common courtesies, the regular commitments, the showing up, the communication, the sharing of interests, though it is regular and systematic, that's where the Lord often adds to you something more. If you're faithful with a little, the Lord said, I will make you Lord over much. If you're there, that's when the next thing comes, the next understanding. And the thing about these two letters, these first and second Thessalonian letters, is the first one and the second one have a lot in common. But there are things in the second that you won't get in the first. There's understandings, there's grips. And out of their fellowship, of ordinary, just regular fellowship that they're developing together, their understanding is growing, they're getting deeper. Their grip on the situation is increasing. And that's what we'd expect. You know, we're not just called to be Christians, we're called to grow in our faith, to grow in understanding, to grow in our ministries, to develop, to mature. In short, a change is expected. A change is expected. A transformation that takes place. Gradually, here a bit, there a bit, line upon line, statute upon statute, digging the ground, digging the trenches, digging the... You know what it's like? It's when you see the building site, the diggers are around there for ages, aren't they? They're out there for ages. It's all mud and it's miserable and rain and muddy and nothing seems to be happening. And then seemingly in 5 minutes, there's a building there. Because they've dug the trenches, haven't they? They've got in there and they've done the work. They've done the work. And any church you see that is truly effective, you underpinning that is genuine fellowship, real fellowship, a real connection between the people, a genuine unity in Christ. And out of that, anything that is truly of the kingdom will come. You can't fake it. You can't make it. You can't put on a show. You know, God knows us. He knows our situation. He is not deceived. We can't pull the wool over his eyes. And he cares about us enough to deal with us as we truly are, doesn't he? And in his goodness, he gives us so much more. But that's just the grace of God. And thank God for that grace. I said about it's not just about turning up to meetings. What I'm trying to say is that this thing of fellowship, committing to one another, is something that is natural to this. It's the Spirit of God that's in you that draws us together. It's not something you have to pump up and prime. It's just something that is natural by the Spirit of God. But if you don't think you'll be tempted and offended and put off, and there will be any one of a number of reasons to fall back, pull back, let go, give up, set back, whatever it is, they're going to come. They're going to come to try and crush what is natural to you and what Christ has put in you. And we have to be on our guard, don't we? And be persistent and consistent like these people to keep communicating. And this isn't about coming to meetings. It's good to come to meetings, don't get me wrong. But you can come to a meeting and you go, how are you? Fine. I sit down and I'm praying. And then I'm singing and I'm listening and I'm speaking. I have a cup of coffee. And bye, and I'm gone. And it's possible that no connection has happened. And fellowship is a connection. These people genuinely care about each other. I think we're going to see it in a moment when you get down to verse 3 there and you look at the character of their fellowship with each other. Fellowship matters. Okay, I'm making my point. Do you get my point? Fellowship matters. And as you get down into it, you look at the character of the church. We're going down from verse 3 onwards now. That although this kind of consistency is going on, that the circumstances the people are living in, their situation, their actual life situation, hasn't changed at all. Between the first letter and the second letter, nothing has changed. There's no dramatic change. It's not like they were in this situation, they wrote a letter to Paul, he prayed for them, and then everything was made better, and now they're writing to him saying, oh, all the problems have gone away. No, nothing has changed. They are still in the trenches, they still have difficulties, they're still under pressure, they're still glorifying God under that pressure. But their lives essentially are the same. And what's a real shame, this is a tragedy you see sometimes, is that fellowship begins to drift. People's commitment to each other and to the gospel drifts. Other things begin to creep in. A coolness, an indifference, a casualness can happen. And then something happens. I've got a dear colleague in the gospel in Bristol, and he's just said, you know, like, our prayer meeting started to get really quite a bit thin on the ground, Sunday evenings, blah, blah, blah. And this isn't a whinge about all this sort of thing. I'm just telling you what happened. And then his wife, who's just in her 30s, got cancer. And it's terminal. And then everybody started to show up. And that's a really, really good thing. But it shouldn't, he kept saying, why did it have to take this? This is just the nuts and bolts of life, not a time for exceptional circumstances. He's not writing to Thessalonians because they're being persecuted. He's writing to them. He'd be writing to them whether they're being persecuted or not. He's writing to them because he loves them and they're one with each other and he cares about their situation. Rain or shine. That's fellowship. That's the commitment. And it's a shame, isn't it? But in this situation, their circumstances, so he's not writing to them because something dramatic has happened. And the other thing that can happen is, you know, you can say, well, I want to get involved in people's lives, even if they're facing difficulties. And these people were facing difficulties. And we love, don't we, to go in there and bang, bang, I've got bang, going to solve your problems, bang, bang, you know, now we're going to, and everything's going to be better. And then bang, bang, all my bullets have gone, and there's still loads of baddies, and the problems haven't gone away. And you think, well, I'm just going to go and fight someone else's battle over here, and where it's going to be a little, you know, I might get a bit of a win. The fact is that their problems were still there. It's like, will you still maintain fellowship with somebody when they still haven't got a job? They still have not got a job. And they still have money difficulties. And they're still sick. And they still don't understand predestination or whatever it is. How consistent and persistent will you be, though there's no change? And that's what I love about this, the fact that they just keep communicating with each other, whether things change or not. They're committed. They're stuck in. And that is really inspiring to me. I find that really heartening. They're still being persecuted. But it's wonderful, isn't it, to see in verse 3 onwards. They are being persecuted, but they're still living for Christ. They're still living for Christ. And that is just ordinary Christianity. Pressure and praise. That's it. Just keeping going under pressure and glorifying God. And I'm afraid, to be the bearer of bad news, you know, it's probably not going to change. Just encourage each other. Encourage each other. And this is what I find so exciting when I find this letter, is that the world's not changing. The world is not going to change. You know, you read the newspapers in the 1800s, and there were wars over here and problems over there and da-da-da-da-da. You read the newspapers today or whatever online, there are wars over here and there's problems over here, there's work health concerns, there's somebody obsessing about something. The world is fundamentally not changing a great deal. But look at these people. Look at them in verse 3. They are changing. See how they're changing. I ought to thank God for you, brothers, rightly, because your faith is growing more and more. They're changing, aren't they? They're changing. The world's the same, but they're not the same anymore. They're being transformed, aren't they? And you look on there, and your love is increasing. Everyone for each other. They're not the same people they were. The character of that church is changing all the time. If you visited that church a few months before, the world's the same, the situation's the same, but is the character of the church the same? No. They are being transformed as a church. It's not the same church in a way as it used to be. The world's just the circumstances are the same. But Christ's work in them is changing their lives. They're more loving. They're more positive, more hopeful, more patient, more optimistic about the future, more confident in God, more clear about the gospel. That's the drama. That's the point I'm trying to make. It's not going to get on the front page of the Sun, is it? Church in North Bradley grows in faith. Maybe not. Okay? In a way, it's a secret work of God. But as far as this is concerned, it is the real thing. It's the thing that he's delighting in, isn't it? To see people growing in their faith and being changed as a church. So, you may still have a difficult life. My heart goes out to you. And I hope your heart goes out to me that I face my problems too. That's just part of life, isn't it? We're here for each other. We're here for each other. But I'd like to think that our love for each other grows. Our care for each other grows. Our confidence towards God grows. So, I think that's the second point, really. Fellowship, it really, really matters. And it's not dependent on the circumstances at all, isn't it? We've got to keep encouraging one another. All right. Now, look, third thing, because I think in one sense, when you get into this, you're getting into something that this letter in the Second Thessalonians contains in a way that perhaps some of the other letters don't. This is stuff that's very, very unique to the Second Thessalonians. It talks about the time that's coming, because as we said, the world pretty much is going to stay pretty much like this in a lot of ways. An ordinary Christian life is going to stay pretty much like ordinary Christian life. But if you think it's going to be like this forever, you're mistaken. And we get lured, don't we, into a sense of security. Everything, Max Clifford, I'm sure, was living in a sense of security for quite a long extended period of time, and it's all right, and I've got away with it, da 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 da. And then one day, things change. Things change. And I think that's what he's reminding them about. Because they're stuck into their situation. They're stuck into the groove. They're doing their work. They're seeking the Lord. They're building fellowship and all the race. And he wants to get them to step back for a minute and remind them that this secret work, this thing that really has no particular profile in the world, is more important to God. And there is a day coming when it will be the most important thing in the whole wide world. It's the thing that everybody's going to want. It's the thing that everybody's going to need. That's how markets work, isn't it? You know, the clever market money, they see the thing that in a certain point in the future is going to be the thing that everybody's going to want. Right now, it might be cheap as chips. But I can see in 10 years' time, if I have this, everybody's going to be coming to me because it's the thing to have. And this faith, this love, this fellowship, what he's making them aware of, is that it may not be valued by other people. The world may look at you, hey, you're so cool, you go to church. Do people come up and say that to you? Hey, that's so cool, you're a Christian, that's wonderful. Do you find that often? Do your friends say that? But there's a day coming, which is very clear in here, where it is going to be the thing, the only thing, actually. And that's quite a sobering thought. Bob Marley said, I'm not going to try and sing it. You think you're living in heaven, when in fact, you're living in hell. Time will tell. Time will tell. It's that sense, isn't it, that something is maturing, something's happening secretly, like a plant sown in the ground, a seed sown in the ground. There's nothing much to see. You look out in the field, there's nothing much to see. It's just a bit of dirt. It's a bit of dirt. Nothing. The day comes when it surfaces, and then you see what it is. And there are people, and it happens, doesn't it? They're just carrying on indifferently in life. They're just carrying on. What a beautiful day it is today. Everybody agreed? It is beautiful today. But there's a difference between the people who look at the beauty of it and go, thank God. And most people, I would imagine, would just go out there and go, what a beautiful day. What a beautiful day. But when you meet God, and there's no sunshine, but you've just got God, what have you got? It's just your relationship with Him. That's it. Your life is just what you have with Him. And the world changes. The world changes. People get a shock sometimes. They just carry on. They just carry on. Carrying on, carrying on. Digging their trench, doing their thing. And then something happens. And they realize they've got nothing. They've got nothing. People have their you know, in life, they get their little moments where they look over the brink. They look out into the abyss. I remember, you know, somebody I knew, you know, was getting older and wanted to do a trip and wanted to go and see the Grand Canyon. Why do you want to see the Grand Canyon? I want to know what it is to look down into the abyss. I somehow think that if I can look, because it's a mile down, you know, if I can look down into the abyss, it might help me prepare for the fact that one day I'm going to have to kind of launch out into the abyss. We're all going to have to go, aren't we, at a certain point. We need to be ready. We need to be ready because we're going to meet God. We're going to meet God. And when we meet God, everything changes. Everything changes. And like going back to the building site, then the building goes up. And you see whether there's foundations or not, whether it's built on a rock, built on the sand, Jesus' parables and so on and so forth. Everything hidden is going to be seen. Okay. Justice. We all know, we've been talking about this, haven't we, recently, that our justice system is imperfect. It's a kind of like a necessary evil, you could say. It keeps good people out of prison more than it puts bad people in prison, probably. It's imperfect, but I tell you, when the day comes, when this day I'm speaking of comes, the forensic accuracy of the judgment will be such nothing that is hidden will not be revealed. There will be no mistakes. There'll be no need for an appeal court because the decision will be right. Absolutely right. And everything changes. And the world that we live in, which is so imperfect and is such a compromise in so many ways, and there's so much injustice and injury and so on and so forth going, it all stops. It all stops. And we find ourselves before God. Oh, we live such little lives, don't we? Little lives. The little dramas of our lives. But suddenly it all comes to a climax. That's what this section, all this evidence is that God's judgment is right. The result, you'll be counted worthy for when you are suffering. God is just. He will pay back. There's a day coming where it's all brought to a head. Everything gets settled. All the accounts are closed. The books are finished. Put away your pencils. The exam is over. You know, no more time for revision. The exam is upon you. It happens, doesn't it? And the outcome will be known, and it will be right. It will be right. Do you stop and think about your life? I mean, a lot of the time people just carry on. I carry on a lot of the time. Well, how am I spending my time? What am I really investing into? Where am I putting my energies? Where am I investing my talents? What really matters? What am I doing? And what does God think of the way I'm living my life? Because in the end, that is going to be the subject at hand. That's going to be the questions that are going to be asked. My grammar is not brilliant, okay? I don't know, maybe people will talk grammar better than I was, but, you know, death or meeting the Lord and so on and so forth, it's not a full stop. Honestly, it's so prevalent now. Most people seem to think that you die and that's it. I mean, apart from philosophically, logically, that's an impossibility, so we'll forget about that. But the Bible roundly denies that truth. It says that death is like a semi, it's like a, is it a colon or a semicolon? Two dots. Thank you. That was the test. You passed. Okay? I don't know if you're right, though. And if I understand my grammar well enough, it means after you've got a colon, you have a list of things, don't you? Yes? So the things that go before the colon are kind of the things you're going to talk about. So I went to the shop, go to the shops and get me, colon, parsnips and carrots. Yes? Our life is before the colon. And then after it is judgment, isn't it? We're going to meet God. And at the point where we meet God, whatever we've got, our friends, you won't have them. Your family? Nope. Your house? Nope. Your car? Your computer? Your computer? Your tablet? Your mobile phone? Your iPad? The lot? None of it. It all goes. It's you and it's God. And either you've got something with God or you don't. Because all the rest doesn't count. And I mean, it's not just the good things, because preachers tend to kind of like harp on about getting rid of all the good things. It's like, it's probably because they feel like they're underpaid and everybody else has got more than them, so they're having a bit of a gripe, right? We lose the bad things too. We lose the illness that's so consuming. We lose our financial worries that can occupy our minds. Our desire for status, that ever-grasping sense of wanting to be reckoned, all those things, all the bad things, all the negative, all the hurts, all the injustices, everything stops. There's none of that. It's just you and God. What have you got? What have you got when you haven't got any of those things to be your identity, to be your life? Have you got a life with God? And it all comes to a head, doesn't it? Because really, looking at us now in worldly terms, in worldly terms, most people look at Christians and they go, bless. Don't they? Bless. Little Christians, little chattering Christians. What are they up to? Funny little lot. Funny little lot. In their little meeting houses, you know, disappearing on a Sunday in the beautiful sunshine. Like, hello. The beach. You know, and all that sort of stuff. What are they up to? What are they up to? But the time comes whether the investment you make into fellowship, the investment you're making, the giving of your time, your life, your prayers, your energies, your worship, all those things, the life you have with God and with God's people, suddenly matures like an annuity. I don't even love it when one of those investment plans finally mature. A little annuity is just matured. It's very nice, isn't it? This is going to mature. And you're going to be the ones who have it. You will have what you need on that day. It's going to be quite a day. It's going to be quite a day, isn't it? And the very fact that you have faith today is a reason to be hopeful. Faith, you have confidence in God today, and in doing these things is a reason to be hopeful. Although anybody looking in, I think you've missed the train. You got on the wrong boat. You'll be there. You will be there. That's the point I'm trying to make. I was going to skip that illustration, amusing though it was to me at the time. There's a lot of stuff that sticks in the throat, isn't there, in this world? There's stuff that can get you down, make you cross. You know, get you angry, get you bitter, get you twisted. These people were being mercilessly persecuted for nothing they had done wrong by people who were certainly not their betters and had no rights in the great scheme of things. And this passage here tells us that there's a payback. There's a payback. I went to dinner not a million years ago, and I sat next to this very lovely lady. And we got into a lovely conversation about this, that, and everything. And it was swimming along. We were laughing. We were having fun. Had a glass of wine, chatting. There were other people. Lovely atmosphere. And then she asked the fateful question. So, what do you do? I'm a Baptist minister, I said. And honestly, I needed to wear a bib. She nearly spat her drink out, you know. So, like this. She was mortified. So after we gave CPR and recovered her and stuff like that,
what are you doing here?
And afterwards, she started to ask loads of questions. A really good conversation, actually, talking about the Lord and so on. But she said, Baptist minister, let me just get this straight. Aren't you the ones that kind of like thump the Bible and preach heaven and hell? And it was tempting to sort of say, no, not me. No. I'm not like that. No. You must be thinking of the fundamentalists in America and, you know, I want to distance myself. So I'm going to thump this Bible right now. And I'm going to point you to these verses here. Verse 9, for example. They will be punished with everlasting destruction. Now, I'm not doing it as a kind of foaming at the mouth kind of stuff, whatever. But I am pointing you to the fact that it is written. It is written. And it's there. There is an eternal judgment. Eternal punishment is here. Everlasting destruction. Shut out from the presence of the Lord. That's an awful thing, isn't it? You're just banging on the door. And nobody answers. It's there. And people who haven't really been appreciated very much here are just marveling at Jesus. That's what we see in verse 10, isn't it? I love that word marvel. Kind of, I know the comics and all the rest of it, but we don't use it very often. But quite clearly, for that, it's going to be, in one sense, marvelous. Don't get me wrong. There's nothing marvelous in that sense about the destruction of the wicked. There is no delight in that. And don't withhold the gospel from anybody because you think, well, I don't like them very much, and I'm not going to tell them about Jesus. Tell your worst enemy. Tell your worst enemy. Tell the person you hate at work. Tell the neighbor. Tell anybody, everybody, about Jesus and to escape from the coming judgment. Because it is like a flaming fire, we read here. And I'm not better than any of them. And if I'm going to escape, it's by the grace of God and have enough grace to share that with somebody else. They're just a human being just like you. Let them have the confidence, being able to meet Jesus in peace when he comes. But there's another aspect to this, is that for the believer who's just been quietly fellowshipping, committed, stuck in, day in, day out, there's a time when you are going to see Jesus. And that is going to be marvelous. Because that, in the end, is the fulfillment of our hopes and our dreams, isn't it? I love the play, I love the Mark drama, and I love preaching from the gospel. I love the Bible. I want to see Jesus. And I'm persuaded that I will, and it will be marvelous. And that's my hope, that's my dream, that's my payout. To see him in the day of his coming. What relief that will be to see him. So, concluding, finishing. Live worthy of the gospel. These are great and glorious things, aren't they? And it calls for a response, a changed life. A changed life, growth, deepening our faith, our care for each other. The world's not going to help us, you know. Nothing against the world, but it doesn't. They don't owe us anything. Trust God, and help each other. That's what I'm reading here. Next time, chapter 2, the man of lawlessness, the end times. Let's tell your friends, and. But I want you to remember, the third chapter finally comes back to the business of just, in the meantime, carry on. All right, Andy, I'll hand back to you.